Isaac started his sermon this morning talking about the importance of not letting our culture define the way that we think about things, which is a lot easier than said than done. One of my elders in Rogers, he loves to talk about what happens when you keep dipping a cucumber in vinegar. It eventually changes the character of the cucumber until you can no longer call it a cucumber. You have to start calling it a pickle. And we spend an awful lot of time being dipped into the vinegar of the world. It's hard not to be affected by that. And even when the world gets some things right, it usually doesn't get those things right for the right reasons. And it might not get those things all the way right. And that matters. This sermon, I first preached this sermon on Father's Day earlier this year. And at the time, I had just finished reading a book about the history of family policy in America. And that really got me thinking about why our culture thinks about families in the way that it does, for better or for worse. And it's interesting to me that the idea for Father's Day as a holiday came from a sermon on Mother's Day. Mother's Day was made a national holiday in 1914 by President Woodrow Wilson. And my understanding is that his intent in doing that was to promote strong motherhood as essential to having strong, healthy families, which of course was necessary to having a strong and healthy nation. And that's true. Amen. The interesting thing to me is that Father's Day was not declared a national holiday until 58 years later, in 1972. And so if the goal was to promote the health of families and the health of the home, the strength of the home, then why was our society only promoting one parent? And so one lesson for me there is that if we look to the culture around us to find the answers to a strong home or to develop a healthy worldview or to progress towards truth, we're always going to fall short. Even when our culture gets some things right, it is never going to be enough until we are wholly leaning on God and using His wisdom as we kneel before His throne. And so this afternoon, we're going to be talking about something broader than fatherhood. We're going to be talking about patriarchy. And we're going to talk about it in a very positive way because God talks about it in a very positive way. And I have some specific reasons for leaning into the word patriarchy. And the main reason is because I would just about guarantee that all of us at some level cringed a little bit when we saw that PowerPoint slide. We are trained by our society to be uncomfortable with the word patriarchy. The idea of patriarchy has been hijacked. It's been villainized by worldly philosophies. And the goal of those worldly philosophies is to destroy the godly household. They're not trying to hide that if you read anything that they write or listen to anything that they say. We're going to talk more about that as we go, but it is so important that we maintain a biblical concept and practice of patriarchy, even as the world around us tries to redefine what that means and demonize it. But also, when we properly define patriarchy, we're talking about more than what the world generally thinks of, and probably we're talking about more than what we generally think of when we use that word. And even, you know, in a culture that is increasingly blurring the lines, I think, in regards to the home, in regards to identity, as Isaac talked about this morning, and even in regards to just truth and order, I think it's important that we consider just how important it is to have strong patriarchs and how important strong patriarchs are in God's plan for His people and His creation. And so that's what we're going to do tonight. And I want to begin by talking about the need for this lesson due to the attack on patriarchy, I think is very active in our country today. And I think it has influenced, it's influenced all of us as well. But we have to begin by defining what we're talking about. The word that is translated patriarch is patriarches. It's used in Acts chapter 2 and verse 29 to describe King David. It's used in Acts chapter 7 to describe the 12 heads of the tribes of Israel. It's used in Hebrews chapter 7 to describe Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If you look at the Greek translation of the Old Testament Septuagint, it's used in 1 and 2 Chronicles to describe the heads of the fathers' households that Isaac talked about this morning. It comes from the Greek word for patrio, family, and archo, to be first in rank. And so the way that the Bible describes the role of patriarchs, and I'm simplifying for the sake of time here, is that they are to be the heads of their wives and lead them in a self-sacrificing and Christ-like way. And that's important. It's just not just what they do, but how they do it. And that's the Ephesians chapter 5 passage that's on the screen there, talking about marriage. They are to bring their children up in the training and admonition of the Lord. And we'll talk more about that in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. That instruction is specifically given to fathers to lead the godly instruction and to lead in the discipline of the family. They are to provide for their households. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. In 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 3, they are to submit to Christ as their head, and with all the responsibilities, with all the duties that entails, and then they are to lead their families under Christ's authority. And so as we talk about patriarchy tonight, this is the image that I want for us to see. Not what the world pictures, but the picture that God has painted for us in His Word. And so our working definition might look something like this on the screen. God's design for male leadership in the home. But that's not the way the world thinks about this. That's not the definition that the world is going off of. And even if we're talking about the same thing, that's not how they would see this. The Google AI definition of patriarchy, for whatever that is worth, probably not much, is a social system in which men hold primary power, dominating roles in political leadership, moral authority, social privilege, and control of property. You see what they did? You see how they reframed this? They turned it into a conflict. They borrow the language of philosophers like Karl Marx to interpret society as competing groups that are fighting for power, rather than interpreting these things as people pursuing their God-given roles and responsibilities. It's not about, they have made this about domination rather than leadership. Leadership comes with responsibility. Following this philosophy, the goal is not righteousness. The goal is not a stable family structure. In this worldview, every relationship is interpreted in terms of power or oppression. It's a depressing worldview. It does not reflect reality. It is a perversion from the mouth of Satan. But this is what secularism leads to. When we remove God from the conversation, when we seed the ground that reality is founded upon by the Creator, and we refuse to be led by His word, we end up in the culture of the time of the Judges. And when the goal is no longer guided by God, or at least in line with God's design, there are no more rules. There is no more authority, but whatever we make up and just invent for ourselves. Individualism, as Isaac mentioned this morning, or mob rule, or democracy. These things that train our minds to think in wrong ways. And so as it says in Judges 21 and verse 25, there is no king in Israel. Everyone does what is right in their own eyes. And you notice that even in that sentence, the problem in Israel was a lack of strong male leadership in the nation. There was no king in Israel. But throughout the book of Judges, you see this theme of weak men as being a primary issue in their culture. Gideon was constantly hiding from responsibility at the beginning of his story. But then once God helped him and he had some success with God's help, he got confident and he turns into this bloodthirsty warlord that can't control himself sexually, has many wives and concubines. And then his son Abimelech follows in his footsteps. And then Jephthah, his rash oath leads to his daughter's death. Manoah, displays a very fragile masculinity in Judges 13. And then his son Samson can't stop sleeping with prostitutes and pagan women and telling them all his secrets. And so, the final story in the book of Judges, it deals with rampant homosexuality and a Levite who has a rocky relationship with a concubine. So this is a society where men are not moral leaders, and they're not strong really in any way. But the most obvious failure of patriarchy during this time happens during the story of Deborah. And there are many who hold Deborah up as a feminist icon. But if you actually read the story of Deborah, that is not the case at all. In fact, it was not Deborah who God called to deliver Israel. It was Barak. In Judges chapter 4, and beginning here in verse 6, she sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh and Naphtali, and said to him, "This is Barak's job. Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor? Take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali, from the sons of Zebulun, by Jabin's army." But in verse 8, Barak replies, he says, "If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." So she says, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you are taking, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." And we know the story that Jael takes that tent peg, drives it through Sisera's head into the ground. But this is not the way that it should have been. And Jael never should have had to do that. And Deborah never should have had to do the things that she ended up having to do. This was not the work that God had given them. This is the work that God had called Barak to do. Deborah even appears to allude to the fact in Judges chapter 5, in the song that she sings, she alludes to the fact that she has to act because there are no strong men to do this work. In Judges chapter 5, verses 7 and 8, she's saying, "Village life ceased. It ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. They chose new gods. There was war in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel." The men were totally unprepared to defend their families. Deborah was not a girl boss who overthrew the patriarchy. The whole problem in the story of Deborah was that there was no patriarchy. And what Deborah was trying to do was establish a strong patriarchy, trying to get Barak to take that male leadership, encouraging him to fulfill his God-given role. Men in Israel had abdicated their responsibilities to lead and to protect and to provide for their families. And the same thing has been true in our culture for a long time, that spiritual leadership has been seen as the women's role, the woman's role. If not in concept, it's been true at least in practice. Who is the one pushing church attendance? Who is the one who is teaching the kids about God at home? Who is leading in study and prayer in the family? For most of recent memory, most of our society has been led by women like Deborah because men like Barak have abdicated their responsibility and their duty. But if you look at recent statistics, it's actually quite surprising. According to Barna Research 2025, men are now attending church more often than women. And most of that change is due to men under the age of 30 being the most religious demographic in the United States. That's all very recent change in our culture. Hasn't been normal, has been that way for a long time. And so we need to be ready to support and to encourage and celebrate men taking the lead in their families and in the church. And that means that we have to be thinking correctly about what those roles are. Sometimes the problem is not that, if you turn to 1 Samuel chapter 25, sometimes the problem is not that men have abdicated their role necessarily, but maybe it's true that they abuse their role. And that was the case with Nabal. Nabal in 1 Samuel chapter 25, this story takes place when David and his men, they're on the run, they're hiding from King Saul, they're in need of some help. They had been protecting and providing for Nabal's men, and in exchange they requested to join this very rich man on a feast day, and instead of being a gracious host and displaying hospitality like he should, Nabal sent a message back to David that's really quite insulting. In verse 10, he says, "Who is David and who is this son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who are breaking away from their masters, each one from his master." And so David is insulted by this. He and his men, they put on their swords to go off and kill Nabal. And while Nabal's wife Abigail, she's running around, she's putting food together, she's trying to provide and appease David for the sake of her husband, where's Nabal while that's happening? In verse 36, he's throwing himself a feast without his wife. A feast fit for a king, it says, and he is very drunk. In this case, Abigail takes responsibility for her husband instead of the other way around. And she takes responsibility for her husband not only because he isn't doing his job, but because, as it says in verse 3 of that chapter, he is a very harsh and evil man. Put a pin in that thought. I'm going to come back to it. But I want to talk for just a minute about the phrase toxic masculinity. That phrase was coined in the 1980s to describe certain traits in men that were deemed to be toxic. And then it evolved to be used to describe certain cultural expectations of manhood. And then finally, it came to be used by many people, not just to describe certain traits, but to call masculinity itself toxic. I want to suggest to you this evening that toxic masculinity has never been a problem in the history of the world. It wasn't a problem in the book of Judges. It wasn't a problem even in 1 Samuel chapter 25 with harsh and evil men like Nabal. Lack of masculinity was the problem. And when men abdicate their responsibility as men, or when men corrupt and abuse their responsibility or their positions as men, then it's not toxic. That word doesn't even mean anything because it's been used so wildly. It's not toxic, and it's not masculine. It's sinful, and it's childish. What do we do when these things happen? When men fail to be righteous in their leadership, I would suggest to you that the solution is not to give up on God's design. The solution is not to give up on His order for His creation. The solution is not to tear down the patriarchy, whatever that means. The solution is to promote true patriarchy. And I'm not talking about just put men in charge of their families, put men in position of power or whatever. I'm talking about following God's design all the way to the top. I'm talking about not just more masculine men, but men under Christ. I'm talking about men submitting to Christ and then leading others towards Him. And when that happens, then strong, godly men will hold accountable those who neglect and abuse their roles. I'm not denying that we live in a society of weak men, but the solution is not to demonize masculinity. It's to promote and restore it to be godly and to celebrate that when it is. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, if you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, as Paul is concluding that letter he wrote to the church at Corinth, in verse 13, it says, "Be watchful, stand firm, act like men, be strong." What does that mean? What should we learn from this? For one thing, men acting like men is not a bad thing. Men acting like men, it's a needed thing. And when it doesn't happen, you end up with a lot of problems like they had at Corinth. Think about the problems at Corinth and how they needed to be addressed. If we go back to chapter 1, you've got divisions forming over worldly allegiances and personal preferences. You have men following men instead of Christ. You have a society that refuses the wisdom of God. And so what is needed? In verses 22 through 24, it says, "The Jews request a sign. The Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews, it's a stumbling block. To the Greeks, it's foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, it is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Speak truth. Even when you are opposed, even when you are persecuted, refuse to compromise. Be stubborn in your faithfulness." Stubbornness can be a very good quality when it's applied in the right direction. Stand firm, act like men, be strong. Chapter 3 and verse 12 beginning says, "If anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become clear. For the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire. And the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is." And so as Paul's writing this letter to the Corinthians, there is a day of fire coming. I tend to think from the context that this is talking about a day of persecution, a day of trial, when their faith is going to be tested. When that day comes, how are they going to react to that? Stand firm. Act like men. Be strong. Chapter 5, when you've got a Christian living in sin, like the man who had his father's wife. The problem in Corinth, in chapter 5 and verse 2, was that they had acted as if nothing was wrong. The result in verse 6 is that others in the group were in danger of being influenced by that. Be watchful. Be strong. Act like men. Draw lines when it's needed. Protect those who are faithful. Chapter 6, brethren going to court with one another over physical disagreements. In verse 5 it says, is it true that there is not one wise man among you who can judge between his brothers? Not even one. When there is conflict, be the peacemaker. Be watchful. Act like men. Be strong. Chapter 9. Chapter 9 is all about self-denial for the sake of the gospel, which we'll see in a moment as a hallmark of true masculinity, godly patriarchy. We've already mentioned that self-sacrifice is an important part of patriarchy in marriage, Ephesians chapter 5. But Paul talks about all these things that he gave up in order to be a Christian. In the first half of this chapter, he talks about the sacrifice of becoming all things to all men. And then in verse 27, he says, I discipline my body, I bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself might become disqualified. Self-control, self-discipline, stand firm, be strong, act like men. Chapter 11, talking about the head covering, we already mentioned, submit to Christ, lead your family, act like men. Chapter 13, I think, is important. Chapter 1 Corinthians 13, beginning in verse 4, says, love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It is not arrogant. It does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own. It is not provoked. It thinks no evil. Does not rejoice in iniquity. It rejoices in the truth. It bears all things. Believes all things. Hopes all things. Endures all things. Love never fails. It's interesting when we get to chapter 16 and he tells them to act like men. The very next verse says, let all that you do be done in love. That's part of what it means to act like a man. There is no arrogance. There is no self-seeking in true manhood, true masculinity. There is sacrifice. There is love. Chapter 14, verses 34 and 35 says, let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive as the law also says. And if they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shameful for women to speak in church. Why? I'd say for the exact same reasons why it was shameful for Deborah to have to be the one to go into battle. The same reasons it was shameful for JL to have to be the one to drive a tent peg through Sisera's head. It's because the men need to be fulfilling their role. It's not that women are incapable of doing these sorts of things. It's that God made us to do different things. And we all need to be busy about the things God created us to do. Rather than defining what Paul meant by act like men through our own culture, through our own stereotypes that we have learned, why don't we just define it by the way Paul says it's going to affect the church at Corinth, by the problems he says it's going to solve. He's telling them to speak the truth, to stand firm in it, to endure suffering, to exercise self-control and self-discipline, to prioritize other people above themselves, to make peace when there is conflict, to lead their families, to lead their church, to love sacrificially, to take care of people, to protect people. And ultimately, it's about submitting to Christ. And so, back in Judges chapter 5, the first line of the Song of Deborah, in verse 1, it says, when leaders led in Israel, when the people volunteered, bless Yahweh. It was the lack of leadership, and it was the lack of people volunteering for the work that led to all of their problems. And I think the same thing was true at the church of Corinth for all of their divisions and all of their compromises. Why is it so important that men act like men? It's because when we follow our God-given roles, there is order. And the opposite of that is chaos. And that's what was happening in Corinth, both in families and in the local church. And the solution was not to overthrow the traditional order of patriarchy. It was to establish it in righteousness. Well, what does that look like? If you look in Job chapter 31, I have a whole lesson comparing Job 31 and Proverbs 31 to talk about what it means to be a good man or a good woman. And when you look at Job 31, as we're about to do, you discover that the primary characteristic that describes a good man, at least according to Job, is restraint. Restraint implies that you have the strength and the ability to do some damage, but instead you choose to use that strength for good. If the only reason you don't do bad things is because you can't do bad things, well, that doesn't make you a very good person. But if you have strength and you are in the position of a patriarch, you can choose to use that like Nabal did, or you can be like Job. And so Job in verse 1 made a covenant with his eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? It's the same thing we read from Paul in 1 Corinthians 9. self-control, self-discipline. In verse 5, Job did not walk in falsehood, but in verse 6, in integrity. He might have had the ability to cheat or to steal, but he wanted to be weighed on honest scales. As a patriarch, Job knew that his word needed to mean something. In verse 9, Job didn't allow his heart to be enticed by a woman. He didn't go looking to spend time alone with his neighbor's wife. That's very interesting to me because for all of the polygamy that happened in the Old Testament, especially among wealthy and powerful men, Job is the greatest man in all of the East, and he has stayed true to his one wife. And verse 13, Job did not rule over his servants with an iron fist, but when they made complaints against him, he listened to them. He did not consider himself superior to them in worth. In verse 15, he said, "Did not he who made me in the womb also make them?" Just because they had a different role that was of higher authority, that did not make them inferior to be walked on. Authority does not equal oppression, like the world likes to think. Authority means responsibility. In verse 16, Job did not oppress the poor or widows. In fact, he used his position to help them. In verse 18, he adopted the orphans. He raised them like a father, like a true patriarch. He guided the widow, cared for her. He clothed the poor and the naked in verse 19. Verse 24 and 25, he did not rejoice in his wealth or boast about it. He was not enticed by the worship of things that are not God, recognized and served the God those blessings came from. In verse 29, he did not rejoice in the destruction of his enemies or even curse them in verse 30. And so rather than using his wealth for his own benefit, verse 31 and 32, he took care of people. He fed them good food. And not only his own people, but he opened his tent even to strangers. In verse 33, he did not hide or cover up his sin because he feared the people. But he was honest about his faults. It's very interesting. Some translations here in verse 33 say, "If I have covered my transgressions as Adam did." Well, what did Adam do? Rather than taking accountability, taking responsibility, he blamed everything on his wife. That's not what godly patriarchs do. In verse 38, Job took care of his property. He wasn't lazy. And when he worked, in verse 39, he took care of those people who worked for him. What do all of these things tell us about Job? Job was not concerned with building himself up. He was the greatest man in all of the East, but he didn't get there by taking advantage of people. He didn't do that by gaming the system. He got there by being a godly leader, prioritizing the people that were under him, by doing what was best for the people under him. Not by doing what was easier, what was comfortable, or what might have been desirable for him, but doing what was right, and by restraining himself from doing what he could have done, things that might have been more physically rewarding for him in the short term. And when we think about that kind of restraint, who better can we think of than Jesus? That even under such great injustice, when that great injustice was done to him, much like the injustice that Job had to go through, Jesus demonstrated an even greater restraint by not calling down that legion of angels to destroy the world and set him free. He chose rather to submit to his Father, to sacrifice of himself, because it was the best thing for the people who were submitting to his authority. Masculine strength is controlled strength. That doesn't mean it's never aggressive. Jesus could be aggressive. But it means that even when it is aggressive, it is controlled, it is measured, it is purposed for the benefit or protection of others. Godly patriarchy is not the ability to exert strength. It is being a good steward of that strength. And when we think about patriarchy, this is the sort of thing that we should think about. This is patriarchy in a biblical worldview. And the world has really done a remarkable job of propagandizing their distorted view. A lot of what we have been covering is talking about godly masculinity in general. Now I want to apply those things more specifically to leadership in the home. In Genesis chapter 18, in verse 19, this is right before God starts to talk to Abraham about the potential judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. And God is talking to himself here about whether or not he should even tell Abraham about what is going on and what he is thinking he's going to do. It says in verse 19, "For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him." So this verse, it begs the question, what does that have to do with Sodom and Gomorrah about to get nuked? And I think the answer is that God is communicating about his decision to judge these people because it has something to do with Abraham's training as a patriarch. Abraham is responsible, God says, for commanding his household in such a way that they keep the way of the Lord. Well, what does that mean? Well, it's God's way. It's the way that God walks, the path that he walks, and Abraham's household is going to walk it with him. They are to be like God. And if Abraham is going to help his household to be like God, then he needs to parent like God parents. And he needs to make judgments like God makes judgments. He needs to be a patriarch like God is a patriarch. He needs to know about enforcing righteousness and justice. He needs to know what happens when those things are not upheld. And it's really interesting because what kind of masculinity do we see when we get to Sodom and Gomorrah? Other than Lot, I would say we don't see any. We don't see any self-restraint. We don't see any self-control. We don't see any hospitality. We don't see any protection of the vulnerable. We see no men acting like men. What we do see is the city's going up in a ball of smoke. And so in order to be a good patriarch, Abraham has to command his household, but he has to do it righteously and fairly and in accordance with the way of the Lord. He has to make sacrifices. He has to move all around and live in tents. He has to be circumcised. He has to leave his father's household. He has to leave the religion that he was raised with. He has to put God even above his own children. Ishmael, he sends away. Ask Isaac, he's willing to sacrifice. And guess what? That ends up being the best thing for his children. I think one of the most dangerous qualities to a Christian man that is prevalent today is just being passive. Passivity. That's the idea of letting things happen without resistance, without response, submitting to the will of outside influences, lacking initiative, letting things happen to you rather than taking charge of situations. We see passivity as a constant problem for men throughout the Bible. People failing to take responsibility to lead. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6, when sin enters the world through Adam and Eve, do we see Adam looking and seeing his wife reaching for the fruit of the forbidden tree, try to stop her? Or when he realized what she had done, did he put his foot down and did he say, that is not the way things are going to work around here? No. She also gave to her husband and he ate. He let it happen. He submitted to the outside influence. Genesis 16, Sarah knows that God has promised Abraham a nation in his lineage, but she hasn't had a son. And so she says, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children through her. And Abraham says, God promised me that he would give me a son who would receive all these promises. God gave me you as a wife. God is faithful. He will do it. No, it's not what he says. Abraham heeded the voice of his wife, it says. And he begins this pattern that we see through the whole Old Testament when he goes into Hagar, the Egyptian, for aid instead of going to God. 1 Samuel 3:13, the man of God comes to Eli, warns him, he better get his boys in line. They've been sleeping with the women who come to worship at the tabernacle. They've been stealing God's portion of sacrifices. So Eli says, boys, stop it. But it's just words. His sons do not stop. So God says, I will judge this house forever for the iniquity which he knows because his sons made themselves vile to me. And he did not restrain them. Boys will be boys. I told them no and they didn't listen. What else can I do? Passivity. And then you can contrast that against men like Nehemiah. Nehemiah is one of the best, most proactive leaders in the Bible. Nehemiah chapter 1, Nehemiah finds out that the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, the gates are burned with fire. And so he mourns and he weeps and he prays and he fasts for many days. In chapter 2, Artaxerxes gives him an opportunity to do something about it when he asks, why are you so sad? And Nehemiah says, why shouldn't I be sad when the place of my father's tombs lies waste? And Artaxerxes says, what do you request? And Nehemiah had an answer. He hadn't just been moping. He hadn't just been complaining. But he has a plan. And he says, send me to rebuild it. And he says, I need diplomatic papers. I need timber. This is how long I'm going to be gone. This is when I can be back. He goes to Jerusalem. He rides around the city to assess the damage. In chapter 2 and verse 17, he comes to the people and he says, you see the distress that we are in. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem. And the people say, let us rise and build. And they just keep running into problem after problem after problem. And we could talk about how Nehemiah, he provided for the needy by refusing his rightful pay. He rebuked the nobles and the leaders for exploiting the poor. He stayed above reproach and he walked in integrity. He contended with the people they're trying to corrupt Israel, even striking them and pulling out the hairs of their beards, which Olivia has done to me and it hurts. But to me, one of the best lines in the book is chapter 4 and verse 14. When Tobiah and Sanballat, they're making threats before the wall is complete. The builders are working with a sword in one hand and their tools in the other. And Nehemiah says, "Do not be afraid of these men." He says, "Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, for your sons, for your daughters, for your wives, and for your houses." What application does that have for us today? Well, we're in a warfare too. We are surrounded by pagan influences constantly too. How are the walls around your home doing? What influences are you allowing to make it through your defenses? Remember, you're not fighting this battle just for you, as Isaac talked about this morning. This is for your brethren. It's for your family. Don't shy away from what it says in Jude 3. Contend earnestly for the faith. Fight. The battle may be harder to see because, as it says in Ephesians 6, we do not fight against flesh and blood, but it is the role of the patriarch not only to fight that battle himself, but to lead his wife, to raise his kids, to go up against principalities and powers and the forces of the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places, and to take up that whole armor of God to be successful in that fight. Because the reality is, whether we recognize it or not, there are Tobias and Sanballats at our gates all the time today. There are influences trying to make their ways into our lives and the lives of our families, what's on TV, what is coming into the home through the internet, through social media, the worldviews communicated in books we read, the way that our kids dress in regards to modesty, the teachings they're exposed to from evolution to Calvinism, the habits of productivity or laziness that we allow them to develop in front of a screen. It's our duty as men to protect ourselves and our families against these things. It's such an important job. In Ezekiel chapter 22, God is laying out judgment against Israel, and the nation is filled with false prophets, and they're oppressing the poor, they're failing to distinguish between what is holy and what is profane, and God's just ready to throw everything into the furnace. In verse 30, he says, "I sought for a man among them who would make a wall, who would stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land that I would not destroy it, and I found no one." He was looking for one man who would do what it says in 1 Corinthians 16 and act like a man, who would stand up for truth among false prophets, protect orphans and widows and the poor, and defend what is holy from being defiled. And there was not a single man. And so in verse 31, he says, "I have poured out my indignation on them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath, and I have recompensed their deeds upon their own heads, says the Lord God." There's a false belief displayed in the lives of many people that the work of the kingdom takes place primarily in the local church and almost always at the church building. And I would suggest heavily to you that kingdom work takes place every moment of every day and primarily in the relationships of the home. And while our culture typically defines the household as a father and a mother and children, that's a very narrow view compared to what the Bible teaches. The word patriarchy does not imply, it does imply the concept of fatherhood, but the qualities in the work that we're discussing do not pertain to only people with physical children. How much of what we have discussed has to do with providing for orphans and widows? Not just providing physically, but not just for literal orphans and widows, but being a patriarch to people who need a patriarch, a provider, a leader, a defender, someone to contend for the faith, to build walls around them and stand on them in the gap. Okay, so we've talked about modern campaign to destroy patriarchy. We've seen the vision for restored and righteous patriarchy. How do we do that practically? And how do we do it not only for ourselves, but how do we promote it in other men to be righteous leaders as well? It has to start with us leading our own families. And again, this is not the kind of headship that just says, "I'm in charge, you have to submit to me." It is the headship in Ephesians 5 that loves your wife just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. It's leadership by example and by sacrifice. The leadership of Jesus is one where he washed the feet of his disciples and they still called him Lord. And so yes, it's important. It's servant leadership, but it's leadership and it's headship. And it's not just a ceremonial or symbolic position. It's not just we have an equal say and one of us has a tiebreaker. It is responsibility. It is accountability. And we can't be passive in our role. If you drop down to Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, it says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord." Or some translations might say discipline and instruction. A lot of men might be like Adam in Genesis 3 and pass the responsibility off to their wives. And they play an important role with this, but who is leading the effort? And who is taking charge of that duty? Of course, this reminder is definitely for me as a new father. But it is dad's responsibility to say, we're not going to wear that, that's not modest. It's dad's responsibility to say, we're not going to watch that, that's inappropriate. We're not going to listen to that music because it's training you to think incorrectly about relationships. We're not going to that concert or that ball game and missing an opportunity to serve God for that. You're not going to keep wasting time escaping reality on video games. I'm going to take you outside and teach you how to build something. It's not that mothers can't do those things or shouldn't also be doing those things. But like the story of Deborah, it's not primarily their responsibility, and they shouldn't have to be the ones to take it. The buck stops here. And leading in the discipline and instruction of the Lord means that fathers should be leading in Bible study at home. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, it says, "You shall teach them these statutes diligently to your own children. You shall talk about them when you sit in your house, when you walk in the way, when you lie down, when you rise up." The majority of spiritual conversation shouldn't happen in the building if we are leading in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. God gives that responsibility to parents. And Sunday is the day when we come together as a local church, but we should be studying and praying and talking about God throughout the week. And we have to start there and then come here. And then it spreads from there. Philip Shoemake used this illustration 4 years ago. It really stuck with me. He said something like, "I really love to light sheep on fire and watch them bump into each other." The Bible says it like this, Proverbs 27 and verse 17. It says, as iron sharpens iron, a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. And so why is it important that we develop strong relationships with each other outside of this building? It's because we're all involved in the same fight that primarily takes place when we're not here. And that's true for all of us. But I don't think that it has traditionally been practiced enough, and especially not for men. These relationships, the Titus 2 relationships of older teaching younger, the Jonathan and David relationships of brothers in arms strengthening each other's hands in God, those are essential in men needing what becoming what men need to be. And we can't do that on our own, especially not in our culture. And finally, the way that we promote godly patriarchy is by not allowing these leadership qualities and responsibilities to be limited by the walls of our homes. Job, Abraham, David, these men did not only perform the duty of patriarch towards their own children, they became patriarchs in their communities. And this was not an uncommon way of thinking about patriarchal responsibility until very recently in terms of history. Things that we think are normal have never been normal. They're only normal for us. And when you look at history, we're the weirdos almost 100% of the time. And there's one historian that says, "Father of the community" is a phrase to describe the American colonial period. Another historian wrote that all a man's household, including servants, hired hands, extended family, local orphans, apprentices, indentured servants, whether they're related to you or not, that is a man's family. And if we have a greater historical understanding of patriarchs like that, think about the influence of Cornelius. In Acts chapter 10, we're told in verse 7 that he sent two of his household servants and a devout soldier from his cohort to fetch Peter. In verse 22, Cornelius' slaves tell Peter he's a just man, one who fears God, has a good reputation among all the nation. Verse 24, Cornelius is waiting for them. He'd called together his relatives and his close friends. Verse 27, Peter went into the house, discovered that many had come together. Chapter 11, verse 14, Peter says, what does Peter say the angel told Cornelius? He says, "Peter will tell you words by which you and your household will be saved." Well, that word household in the case of Cornelius is describing an awful lot more people than just his wife and kids. That wasn't just his wife and kids. He had become a patriarch, a father figure, a defender, a protector, a provider for his community. And in doing so, he was able to lead all of those people toward God. And as Isaac said this morning about the Philippian jailer, he was already the kind of man that when he decided what direction to go, his family said, "I'm right behind you." Being a godly patriarch isn't only about being a father to your children. It's about being a father in the faith to anybody that you can be to. And you think about the concept of a biblical patriarch, that's a profile of eldership. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2 mentions hospitality as a qualification. That doesn't mean just invite people over to my house. That means taking care of people who need help. being a provider, being a defender to them. It's the same. We see a lot of the same things there that we see about patriarchy in the household. And I think it's worth noting that those things are not listed as responsibilities that the current elders have. They're listed as qualifications to be considered in order to be an elder. And so that's not something that the elders are supposed to work on and have. That's something that everybody has to work on. And the goal is to fit into that profile. Patriarchy is so important. Patriarchy sets the tone of those people who follow you. Patriarchy decides what kind of a household that you're going to have. They can even make a difference beyond their just physical families. And I think that fathers naturally tend to be hard on themselves and always think they could be doing better. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But it's also important that we don't get discouraged in that. We're all doing the best that we can. We're supposed to lead by example. We're supposed to prioritize the right things. We're supposed to love our people and take care of them and follow God. And the rest of those things come. Joshua said in Joshua 24 and verse 15, "As for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord." Joshua was allowing himself to be led by God. He was commanding his household to follow his leadership under God. And by his example and influence, he was becoming a patriarch for the entire nation to follow God. And ultimately, the whole point of patriarchy is about those patterns that Isaac talked about this morning. Emulating our Father in heaven, our patriarch. Providing, protecting, leading others the same way that he leads us. Back to Abraham in Genesis 18. Learning the way of the Lord about righteousness and justice and commanding those under our authority and giving them responsibility to do the same, showing them how. When we do that, we become types. Talk about types and anti-types. We become types or pictures of the true patriarch who is God. Won't you submit to the patriarch today? Won't you allow him to be your patriarch, your provider, your protector, your leader, and won't you lead others to him? If we can help you in any way, please find me after services or come forward while we stand and sing.